From the land to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 11th day of February, 2026. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets, really about anhydrous ammonia as it's related to the commodity markets and nitrogen too. That with StoneX's Josh Linville. He analyzes fertilizer for them. Greg Johnson from TGM, Total Grain Marketing, is out of the office for the day. We'll finish out our program, as usual, by hearing from Drew Lerner at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. However, Drew has sent to me his forecast rather than being with us live. He's making presentations elsewhere today. And along the way, we'll also hear from USDA about some of the historic radio program that has been put together over the last century by that agency. And we'll take a look, too, at a couple of news items from the Farm Doc team. You'll want to stay with us for that. I'll also remind you to visit the Farm Doc website or our website at willag.org. At either place, you can sign up for the all-day Ag Outlook. It's coming up on Tuesday, the third day of March, at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
March corn for the day settled at $4.27. That was a penny and a quarter lower. The May down 0.75 cents. Settlement price there at $4.36. And December corn, $4.59 3/4, up a penny and a half. Soybeans, $11.24 a bushel, a penny and a half higher. The May at $11.39 5 up two. And November soybeans, the new crop, 4 cents higher, settled at $11.10 5. Bean meal at $3.03, up $2.20. The bean oil at $57.05, 22 cents lower for the day. Wheat futures, soft red up 9. Settlement price at $5.37 1/4, and the hard red at $5.38 5. 8 cents higher for the afternoon. Live cattle futures in Chicago at $240.97 5, $3.55 higher. Feeders at $367.45, up $2.67 5. And lean hogs per 100 pounds, $1.65 lower at $93.85 for the day. Crude oil, $64.54 a barrel, 58 cents higher. Diesel fuel or heating oil at $2.43 8/10 cents, up 3 9/10 cents. And gasoline on the RBOB, the wholesale price, $1.97 5 a gallon. That's up 1 penny and 6 tenths of a cent. The Dow Jones Industrial Average about 25 points lower at this hour, and the S&P 500 up around 12 3/4 of a point. Don't forget to visit us online at willag.org. That's WILLAG.org, where you can find and sign up for the All Day Ag Outlook coming up at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. It's on the third day of March. It's a Tuesday. The cost is just $40. The full agenda is there. We have a great day of the basics for you, including crop insurance and the fundamentals of the marketplace, land values too, all at the Beef House, but you need to sign up today at willag.org. We're now joined by StoneX's Josh Linville. He follows fertilizer for that company. Thanks, Josh, for taking some time again with us today. I know you've been watching the price of urea, all kinds of nitrogen sources over the winter months. Tell me what you've seen as we head into what may be a very early season for anhydrous rigs to run across the Midwest.
Yeah, so unfortunately, what I've been seeing is a lot of reasons for farmers not want to hear anything I have to say. It's not very much of it's been good news. Of course, a lot of what we watch is Gulf Base, is NOLA Base, because that's kind of our, you know, our base point for North America fertilizers. And since the first half of December, when urea prices dipped to their lowest level, prices are up over $100 a ton since that point in time. And a lot of that continues to be driven globally. It's a lack of Chinese export expectations. It's a lack of European production. There's still a 75% production rate. It's Trinidad production issues. It is a fear of a U.S.-Iran fight shutting off flows from the Persian Gulf. And then when you start to look at it and you look at kind of what nitrogen expectation is for 2026, we keep building this corn crop. It keeps getting to be a bigger number being discussed by the marketplace, and that builds nitrogen demand overall. So that has just continued to provide more and more price strength to the urea market. But to your point, it has been gorgeous in Kansas City. Anhydrous rigs are already running at a full month ahead of when they would normally do it around here in Kansas City, St. Joseph area. Hearing a lot of great forecasts, a lot of fields being cleared off, drying off, frost coming out across large parts of the Corn Belt. we could have an exceptionally early start to anhydrous, and the forecast continued to hold, it could be a very early and long run. Anhydrous is still the cheapest form of nitrogen out there to the farmer, and if they get the chance, I think you're going to see them pile onto it. That's going to have some impact on the anhydrous price, of course, but you could start stealing some demand away from things like urea and UAN if this continues.
I have a twofold question to follow up on that. In the United States, over the last decade, I believe there has been a transition from imported anhydrous ammonia or in supplies to nitrogen being produced in the U.S. near the Gulf. First, is that correct? And am I right that it's about 90% of the NH3 that is applied in the United States that comes from that area or plants in the United States? And then because of that local production in the U.S., is the price of anhydrous lower than the price of other sources?
Yes, on the first part. We do produce a lot more of the anhydrous that we use every single season, every single year. And when you look at it, our production versus our demand, most of what we produce, it stays here to meet demand. I think we still import a little over 1 million tons in from the rest of the world, from places like Trinidad, and a lot of those tons go into that Eastern Corn Belt pipeline, which services Illinois, Indiana, Ohio. But that has helped our price. But you are seeing a premium inland anhydrous price versus a lot of points around the world, but it has helped keep anhydrous as a cheaper option out there because there is so much of it out there. There's always been a lot of people talking that, oh, anhydrous is going to go away. It's dirty. It's this, it's that, it's dangerous. We have not seen that. Anhydrous continues to be a very popular nitrogen source for a lot of farmers out there.
What are you suggesting to producers at this point as they look forward to the spring and their anhydrous or urea nitrogen needs?
That is a great question. And unfortunately, with where we are today, so close to the start of spring season, a lot of our options are off the table. A lot of the time to sit there and look for a great opportunity where maybe grain prices jump and nitrogen prices fall, lock in that better ratio, we're running out of that kind of time. The best advice I can give today for the farmer is have the conversation with your supplier on what you plan on using and when you plan to use it. The farm gate has, as expected, given the financials for the last couple of years and this year, has been much more reluctant in stepping forward to buy their needs. And the supply side, the retailer, the co-op, whoever you buy from, well, they can't take all the price risk. They can't sit there and say, well, I know normally I'm 5,000 ton. I've only sold 500, so I'll just take the risk on the rest of this. Prices are high. They remember 2008 and 2012 when prices fell out of bed. They can't handle that kind of a year. So they have been more conservative on their buying patterns, as has a distribution system. And so all of us to sit there and say that the market feels like it's got a lot of pent-up demand, that could cause some in-season logistical issues. I don't want to go as far as say, oh, there won't be anything. It's going to be shortages. Those types of stories. But it is a situation that we need to watch because there can be a short amount of time when it's the most important to have that supply there. And it just isn't because we bought it just a little bit too late. Having those conversations ahead of time saying, I'm not willing to secure it today, but here are my expectations, can go a very long way in having the market set up and ready to go for you.
Can I ask, do you know why the nitrogen supplies have been constricted? Is China doing that as a policy, or are there other issues? And also, is the EU constricting for a reason?
Yeah, so it's multiple reasons, and a lot of them are globally driven. We always look at it from our own backyard and say, what are we doing to cause this? We are actually still, you look at our NOLA urea price, we are still a little bit of a discount to world replacement today. That's how much we've been following the rest of the world. And China, they are normally one of the biggest exporters in the world. They normally export 5.5 million tons. They might change this program after the Chinese New Year here on the 17th. But as of right now, we have word that they're not going to export again until August of this year. One of your biggest exports, just not there until August. Europe continues to struggle with not only their green energy initiatives, but they've also cut off their cheapest price of gas from Russia. And so their nitrogen production overall is still about 75% of normal. That's millions of tons of nitrogen fertilizer not being produced. That farmer in Europe isn't sitting there saying, well, I guess I'll go without this year. They're going out to the world, and they're competing with folks like us to get those tons and get them brought into the country. Trinidad has been having UAN anhydrous production problems because of a lack of gas supplies. A lot of production turnarounds for repairs have been happening. So it's a long, long list of reasons. And again, most of this list sits outside of the U.S., outside of our jurisdiction, outside of something we can do directly to change it.
Second crop or Safrinha corn is going in the ground now in Brazil, particularly in Mato Grosso. I don't recall, because this is a second crop on that land following soybeans, generally speaking, how much fertilizer they use to get the yields that they have. It's clearly not what the United States would be using, because their yields aren't nearly that high. Do they have a restricted issue with anhydrous ammonia as well?
We've not heard any reports of them struggling, because, again, they don't apply anhydrous quite like we do. They're a little bit more reliant on things like urea. So, and even there, we have not heard of any supply shortfalls or anything there. They act as though they are sitting comfortably.
Your stablemate, in the last time I checked, the deskmate next to you, Arlen Suderman, will join us tomorrow. When you have conversations with him about fertilizer and the size of the corn crop in the United States, does that center around just acres being added over time?
Yes. So when we look at 2026, I can tell you from our fertilizer demand models, we are still using 93 million acres of corn this year. And it's not because we think corn is fantastic and so profitable and all these other things. It's because when we look at corn, it's the best option of a bunch of really, really bad options. When you listen to the crowd that's sitting there saying 95 million acres of corn for 2026, they make a very compelling argument. And frankly, if we didn't take a typical conservative approach into our models, we'd probably already be there. In fact, I heard somebody yesterday at a conference say they've been hearing a company out there saying they think it could be as high as 97 million acres. So the more acres we add is just more supply we're sticking on top of an already oversupplied marketplace. And so that lowers the grain price, and at the same point, that raises fertilizer demand, which, of course, raises fertilizer prices. So it's a double-edged sword, but the farmer's doing the only thing they really know how to do, and that's just survive year to year.
Hey, thank you much, Josh.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Josh Linville is a fertilizer analyst for StoneX, located in Kansas City, Missouri. By the way, USDA will release its first set of figures detailing the corn and soybean acreage possible in the United States this growing season during the Ag Forum this month, and then the first official set of numbers will be released with the prospective plantings report at the end of March. It is a survey of farmer expectations. In today's agricultural news, a couple of stories from the University of Illinois FarmDoc team. They've updated their online crop insurance evaluator tool. The revised tool takes into account recent increases in premium support for the supplemental coverage option, or SCO, and the enhanced coverage option, or ECO, as well as increases in support for the combo product. As a result of these premium support changes, they say many farmers may consider taking ECO and SCO and potentially lowering RP coverage levels, particularly for soybeans in the central part of Illinois. You may see the full article on the FarmDoc Daily website. Tomorrow, the University of Illinois Ag Economist will host a live webinar at 11 a.m. Central Time, detailing the upcoming crop insurance decisions. It will be posted to YouTube later in the day at youtube.com/@FarmDoc. You may sign up to attend live on the FarmDoc Daily website under the Webinars and Events tabs. By the way, once you've opened that, you'll also find a link to the March 3 All-Day Ag Outlook. It, too, will feature a presentation on crop insurance decisions. Tomorrow's webinar, of course, is free. The All-Day Ag Outlook is $40, but it includes lunch at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. Elsewhere from the FarmDoc team, the build-out of grain storage capacity in the United States has stopped. That, according to U of I Ag economist Joe Jansen, he writes on the FarmDoc Daily website that U.S. grain storage capacity grew in parallel with production from 2000 to 2019 at roughly 350 million bushels per year, but has stagnated since across all regions and all facility types. Now, the stagnation, thinks Jansen, combined with continued production growth, has led to record high capacity utilization rates, particularly in on-farm storage. The 2025 crop brought these tensions to a head, with December 1 on-farm utilization reaching 80%. What's less clear, he says, is why investment in grain storage capacity dropped. It's also difficult to determine if current U.S. storage capacity is enough for efficient operation along the grain supply chains. Now, the grain industry, from the farmer outward, thinks Jansen will need to consider these questions as it addresses the continually shifting geography of global grain production and consumption in years ahead. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. Up next, we'll celebrate 100 years of USDA radio. You know, the Agriculture Department's radio service has served the public since 1926, and it's almost as old as the medium itself. And over its century, USDA radio has provided information about farming, ranching, and the department in a variety of ways and formats. Rod Bain has more on USDA radio over the years in this edition of Agriculture USA.
Acknowledged as the first commercial radio broadcast ever. 1920 presidential election results by Pittsburgh's KDKA in November of that year. Soon after, agricultural and consumer news and education programming became a staple of both commercial and public radio entities. That included U.S. Agriculture Department market reports transmitted by an authorized 35 radio stations in 1922. USDA, meanwhile, conducted its own experiments in the fledgling medium. By 1926, a separate radio division was created, joining its highly acclaimed motion picture service in presenting agricultural information to the public. One of the department's first efforts in radio came through a collaboration with the then Bureau of Home Economics.
One of the things they did is they put together a radio program to reach the family farm, specifically the women on the farm.
USDA historian Wayne Conley describes the format of the program featuring the character Aunt Sammy.
The first 5 minutes was kind of like, so we're going to make things a little bit more efficient. Back then, they even had people volunteering to wear pedometers. They kind of recorded and then they kind of figured out, okay, if you move things around here, we can save more time, be more efficient in the home, in the kitchen. And in the middle 5 minutes was, we're going to give you a recipe. So now grab a piece of paper, pencil, and sit down. We're going to give you a recipe. The last 5 minutes was, send us your questions. General enough, we'll answer your question.
Within the first month of broadcast in 1926, over 10,000 letters pertaining to Aunt Sammy and her recipes were directed to USDA. 2 years later, the Agriculture Department would begin the first of several collaborative programs with the major radio networks.
The National Farm and Home Hour.
With the familiar voice of host Everett Mitchell presenting Ag and Rural News, and his trademark greeting to open the show during its over three-decade run.
It's a beautiful day in Chicago. Oh, it's a little on the cloudy side. The temperature's in the 30s, but it's a great day to be alive, and I hope it's even more beautiful wherever you are.
Contributing regularly to such national network radio programs, staff of USDA's radio and later television service. Names making up a Hall of Fame broadcast roster, including the man who had served 25 years as radio and TV service chief, Lane Beatty, recalling contributions of one of his predecessors, Wallace Catterly.
We also furnished special features like a home economics talk.
Also radio service head and Grammy Award-winning jazz engineer.
It's hard to say what you can't do if you want to really work at it.
Jack Towers was putting together every week a half-hour American Farmer program with gaps in it for certain theme music and for an ABC announcer, and he was shipping these interviews and so forth out on tape out to ABC, and that went on for some years.
Another radio network farm and rural show USDA initially contributed to under Lane Beatty's watch.
The Clear Channel Broadcasting Service, Hollis Seavey. He had started a regular weekly program called Agriculture USA. Somebody decided they didn't want to spend the money on this thing anymore, so Seavey came around and asked USDA if it would take over Agriculture USA, and we did.
A program you are listening to at this moment. A program with an over 70-year run. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Todd Gleason coming to you from the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, where WILL went on the air in 1922. Let's take a quick look at the weather forecast. Drew Lerner is not available to us today. However, we do have his weather forecast. He says that Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and far southern Brazil's driest areas will get some rain over the next week to relieve their persistent dryness. Rainfall of 1 inch to 2 inches will be common. A few amounts, nearly 3 inches as well. This should impact most of Argentina, Uruguay, southern Paraguay, and Rio Grande do Sul, ending concerns about crop conditions for a little while in those places. Some follow-up rainfall will be extremely important, he writes, so crop improvement is quite likely as a result of the next 7 days of rain. The center-west and center-south parts of Brazil will also experience a good mix of rain, some sunshine, a little less frequency and intensity for the rain from the southern areas to Sao Paulo and Mato Grosso. In other growing regions across the planet, China will experience more frequent rainfall in the Yangtze River Basin next week and on into the end of this month. The moisture boost there will be great for preparing rapeseed for more aggressive crop development, and the moisture will also help improve pre-planting conditions for spring crops in China. Coming back across Eurasia through Western FSU or the former Soviet Union crop areas, they'll see some frequent bouts of snow, a little rain through early next week. The area to be most impacted will be west of the Ural Mountains and north of Ukraine, where moisture totals of rainfall can be expected in the 1 to 2 inch range. Now, in the U.S. Southern Plains, Drew Lerner writes, wheat and livestock areas will get rain Friday and Saturday. Rainfall of 1 to 2 inches will be common, with some totals over 3 inches in central and eastern Oklahoma, northern Texas. Moisture totals of 0.2 to 0.75 inches, and a few locally greater amounts are likely in western Oklahoma, southern Kansas, and the Texas Panhandle. The moisture will be good for future wheat development, which may occur aggressively if the temperatures stay far above average for too long. The central U.S. plains to northwestern Ohio and southern Michigan, by the way, are unlikely to see much moisture of significance over the next week. Precipitation should fall soon enough after that, though. Temperatures in the heart of North America, he says, will be well above normal. During the next week, the heat will reduce winter hardiness and stimulate some green winter wheat crops in the southern plains, delta, and the southeastern states. Some cooling is predicted for the last week of February. And that's a look at Drew Lerner's weather forecast. Of course, you've been listening to the Closing Market Report on this Wednesday afternoon. Do visit our website. The address is willag.org. There you can sign up for the All Day Ag Outlook. And in the calendar of events, you'll see a way to sign up for tomorrow's webinar from the FarmDoc team. It's an early look at crop insurance decisions. There will also be a segment on crop insurance, of course, at the All Day Ag Outlook. The cost for that one, again, is just $40. It occurs on the 3rd day of March at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. If you've not signed up yet, please do right now. Don't take any more time. Get yourself signed up for one of the best opportunities you have to listen to the FarmDoc team at the end of this winter meeting season. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.